Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've talked a lot about dark money and politics here on the show, specifically in the context of Massachusetts state ballot questions. That's because last year, OCPF, or the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, levied its largest ever fine against a pro-charter school group for violating state election laws because it had masked its donors. Now, the idea is that if groups are trying to influence an election, voters ought to have the opportunity to know where that influential money is coming from. But there is another view, one that says forcing nonprofits to disclose their dark money donors may actually do more harm than good. Paul Craney is a board member with the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, a conservative-leaning nonprofit that promotes fiscal responsibility in government. And he joins us now. Paul, welcome. And let me just start off here by saying that people who are concerned, and there are a couple of them, more than just you, about too much disclosure, they often point to legal cases that I think go all the way back to the NAACP in the 1950s. So what does civil rights have to do with dark money in politics today?
Well, the Supreme Court has actually taken up this issue, and they've ruled on it. Unanimous decision that said, essentially, you know, you had basically Southern racist politicians who were trying to intimidate pro-civil rights groups. Mm-hmm. And the way they're trying to do that is going after these groups, forcing disclosure of its donors, which are members, so they can intimidate, harass those members.
And this is a case in which Justice John Marshall Harlan actually wrote for a unanimous court that folks were at risk of economic reprisal, loss of employment, threat of physical coercion, and other manifestations of public hostility if their membership or support of the NAACP was revealed during the struggle for civil rights in the 50s.
Yeah, amongst other things. I mean, we all know what would happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, so this is interesting because in this question of when and if donors to political or policy organizations should be disclosed, almost everyone refers back to this case, this 1958 Supreme
Right.
Court case. And I agree with you. You make a really important point here that the potential ramifications were extraordinary then.
I
mean, not to put too fine a point on it, lynching, murders, physical violence. That was a reality of the civil rights movement. But you're not saying that the ramifications for billionaire donors to policy organizations now are anywhere near the same as they were for civil rights activists in Montgomery, Alabama in 1958, are you?
Well, let's talk about modern day. For instance, things that people will really kind of understand pretty easily. Let's just say right to work. But let's just say there was a big push in Massachusetts to incorporate some aspects of right to work. Now, what do you think would happen if, for instance, there was a group that was pushing right to work, and a lot of the members, a lot of the donors were construction people that work in Boston who are part of unions? What do you think would happen to those members if they became disclosed?
I don't know.
Probably there'll be some intimidation at the workplace. Another one that's really easy for people to understand is, let's say there was a big push, and there has been from time to time, for the charter school movement. And all of a sudden you start discovering, because you're pushing donor disclosure, that a lot of the members and the donors are public school teachers that are giving money because they do believe that there should be some choice in education. Mm. You know, obviously they would be most likely, you know, chastised, intimidated. There would be some repercussions at the workplace.
So there may be repercussions. We can't know for sure because these are
hypotheticals.
These are theoreticals. But since you brought up charter schools, I mean, we're having this conversation because you heard our coverage about the dark money around donations around question two. I mean, in that case, your theoretical example bumps up against reality. I mean, the reality was it wasn't teachers who were donating to pro question two groups. It was fewer than two dozen individuals who have billions of dollars of money collectively. I mean, I'm still trying to understand what could be the repercussions for them. They're not teachers.
In that case, you know, we have essentially a New York City-based organization who kind of came into the state for kind of a quick expenditure for a ballot question. Is that advisable? Probably not. And I know this because I actually work for a 501c4 nonprofit entity who's based in Boston, who has strong roots. So I would have advised them, why don't you come to the state, get to know the players, actually have a record here for a while. You know, you want to really get involved in Massachusetts, be here for a while, Don't just spend money on one specific thing and then shut your doors and leave.
But I think you're hitting on something extraordinarily important, because everything that you, I think, very accurately described that Families for Excellent Schools, that's the New York-based group that you're talking about, came in and did, and all the things they didn't do, is exactly the reason. That's exactly the reason why people are deeply concerned about dark money, because that is what happens. Groups just come in, they pour a lot of money into a local or a statewide issue, and they don't have a track record. They don't have connections. It's hard for anybody on the outside of that group to understand what's going on, because they pour the money in and then they pull out. I mean, that's fundamentally the problem with non-disclosure, isn't it?
Well, you know, you see it on virtually anything with elections in Massachusetts. I mean, that is their freedom. They are free to do that. The thing is, with these 501c4s, comparing that to candidates running for office, political parties like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and another party, and even for that matter, even super PACs, which are fairly new, but, you know, they've been around for almost 10 years now. C4s engaged in public policy battles, it's relatively newer as far as the way they're able to do it. And a lot of that is because technology is also changing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you have people that hit door knock, you have direct mail, but as you know, technology changes. You have online ads, you have different ways to talk to people. But it is their right, just like it is for any political persuasion in the public policy world, to do exactly what they did.
Yeah,
again,
so
I would advise, hey, that's probably not wise. It's pretty predictable what's going to happen to you if you do it the way that they did it. Basically, what they were doing is they were raising money and donating money to a ballot question. And that's been going on for a very long time, not just last summer or two
summers
ago.
But they weren't registered as a question committee. I mean, that's the sort of legal crux of the matter in Massachusetts.
Right, and that's actually been going on for a very, very long, long time. But what happened was OCPF basically came down on them and interpreted a bunch of different sets of circumstances and put it all together and said, well, when we put all these pieces together, then we find that, you know, you were just basically trying to circumvent the disclosure laws.
I mean, that's OCPF's job, though, right?
That's an interpretation.
That's what a legal investigation into campaign finance, possible campaign finance violations would look like.
Yes and no, because again, this is still relatively new how these groups are operating.
Yeah, so I'm just going to jump in here, and I want to hear your view on this, because OCPF specifically said that the problem was that the entities in Massachusetts existed for no other purpose than to funnel money to the ballot questions, and so therefore they had to register as question committees, which they didn't. And the reason why that matters is in Massachusetts, if you are registered as a ballot question committee, yes, you have to disclose your donors, but there's no cap on the donations.
Right.
So OCPF, I mean, there were examples. Michael Sullivan, the head of OCPF, told us that, you know, there were examples where there were days literally where on the same day a donation, $1 million donation was brought in. That $1 million donation through this other entity was given to the ballot question committee. And you know, as you said, there was a couple of things like that. When they put it together, it was a kind of an undeniable pattern that they found in violation of campaign finance laws here.
Well, again, they found in violation of campaign finance after the fact, right? There was no necessary line that they crossed at the time.
Okay, so this actually gets us back to sort of the deeper point here, right? Which is, you have concerns about what some mandatory disclosure, you have concerns about the impact or the effects of that.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, why do you think people shouldn't know or shouldn't have to know that, you know, on one side, on the opposing side of question two, it was basically a handful of unions that funded $20 million on their side. But then on the pro question two side, it was also a small handful of very wealthy individuals. Why shouldn't we know who they are?
Well, I mean, let's make distinct differences. Knowing the source of funding for folks that want to influence the outcome election when we're talking about the election or defeat of particular candidates, those expenditures should be disclosed. And that's
what's the difference in this day and age between, what's the meaningful difference between funding in support of a human candidate versus funding in support of a ballot question that voters are voting on that could have enormous effect on policy across the state?
The big difference is groups like the group I work for, Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, and many others, is we push ideas. So ideas are not obviously electing or defeating candidates. Do we influence the outcome of elections? We like to think that we do, engage people to think about issues. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, obviously during election time, you see and hear a lot of TV commercials and radio ads talking about, you know, different organizations that say, you know, think about energy when you go to vote.
Yeah.
Think about, you know, solar wind energy. Think about natural gas. Are they telling you to vote for a certain candidate? Absolutely not. They're trying to make you think as a voter, go engage these candidates, ask them where they stand on the positions, and think about those very important issues. And that's actually much different from telling you to go vote for a candidate.
But you could make the argument, though, that advocating for ideas is, in fact, the more important playing field here, right? I mean, especially when we're talking about things like voter referendums, because ultimately, I mean, these are cases in which voters are checking the box on things that could become law.
Well, and we're talking about a little different ballot questions. I'm talking more about pushing policies and ideas,
okay,
right? Because that's where you're starting to see more disclosure of members, donors of organizations. And that's why I say you have to be very careful when you go down that, because that's exactly what we were doing in the civil rights era. We were saying, you know, the civil rights era, they're pushing for more civil rights mm-hmm. for everyone. And what you saw was Southern, very racist, elected officials saying at the same exact time what we're saying today is, well, they want to push for ideas. We should see who their members are. It's the same exact argument. But now it's a little bit more flipped, as if like it's popular and it's kind of cool to say we want to know disclosure of donors. And I think we have to be very careful and just pause on that and say, well, why?
The Supreme Court itself has not been entirely consistent on this issue of disclosure since 1958. I mean, we were looking up a bunch of other cases, and I just want to give you a little mini laundry list here, okay?
Well, they always take on new things because a lot of times the technology is changing. You have so many different states doing different things. So
yeah, but if we're going to point to 1958, let's also look at 1976 Buckley versus Valeo. And in that case, the court held that disclosure laws were justified because they prevent corruption, provide valuable information to voters, and help enforce other campaign finance laws. Now, this, of course, was in the wake of Watergate. In 2011, a U.S. district court judge found that supporters of a California ballot question did have to disclose. And this judge found that the harassment they faced did not rise to the level faced by the NAACP in that earlier case we were talking about. And maybe, you know, most interesting, 2009 Supreme Court case Doe versus Reed, and this is a case in which there was a Washington State voter referendum, an anti-gay marriage voter referendum, and people who signed the referendum did not want to have to disclose that they had signed it. The court found 8-1 that they did have to disclose, and in fact, Justice Scalia wrote that requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage without which democracy is doomed.
Right. So we're comparing a little bit apples and oranges. I mean, signing a petition is one thing. Being a member of a non-government, non-profit entity who occasionally engages in public policy debates is quite different. But going back to Massachusetts in 2013, if I remember right, they were pushing for the first version of the disclosure law. And this was where we actually saw for the first time those expenditures I was talking about before, where we're electing or defeating candidates for office. So PACs, mm-hmm. super PACs and CANTs, those activities were starting to get pushed over to nonprofit entities and what they do.
Right.
So what was very interesting is you had certain lawmakers who just had it in their head that they had to push this disclosure law. But what was very funny in this is that, you know, I knew back then, because I still know now, we follow campaign finance law extremely close, was that there was already disclosure laws on the books in Massachusetts for nonprofits who engage in those types of activities. So that at the time, they call them independent expenditures, which again, that's what super PACs do, and electioneering communications, which are pretty educational in nature. It's just the proximity to an election day.
Right.
So at the time, you had lawmakers saying, we need a disclosure law. But the campaign finance law already had donor disclosure on the books at that same exact time. But it was one of those things, and you know, don't be surprised here, elected officials sometimes pass bills so they can pat each other on the back. I mean, we see that all the time. I mean, think about that. So that kind of goes back to another question with campaign finance law, which is what is the purpose? And is it ever used as a weapon for, you know, political reasons? Absolutely, it's used as a political weapon.
So as we kind of wrap up here, I've heard you raise three major concerns. And let me just summarize them and tell me if I've got this right. That you're concerned about this sort of push to disclosure in that, one, it could expose people to various forms of retaliation.
Absolutely.
Two, we already have laws that should cover most of the things that you say people are concerned about. And three, you said that you're concerned that campaign finance laws can be used as a weapon against particular groups or people.
Oh, well, it's used every day as a weapon. So I think what your listeners should always strive for in a campaign finance law is fairness. And going back to what is the purpose of campaign finance law? The purpose is to remove the corrupting influence from elections. That's the purpose of campaign finance law. Right now in Massachusetts, we have this other law called the union loophole, which essentially says candidates who are running for office can accept up to $15,000 from any union, not only in Massachusetts, but in the country. Individuals, you and I and a lot of your listeners, can only contribute up to $1,000. Mm-hmm. And then corporations, no matter how big or small, cannot contribute a penny at all. So you have three different levels of what is fair.
They can't contribute directly.
Right, and this is all about direct donations to
There are indirect means by which corporations can contribute.
As super PAC, just like with individuals, just like with unions. But direct campaign donations to candidates, which is the mother's milk in politics, is how much does a candidate have in their bank account, in their political bank account. Unions can give up to $15,000.
But we would know which union, though.
But that's $15,000, and individuals can only do $1,000, and companies, employers, cannot do a penny.
But I take your point on that there's a discrepancy there, but we were talking about disclosure, but we would know which unions. They would have to be named. It's not that they could hide their identity.
Right, but this is actually much worse than any type of disclosure. This is giving direct campaign donations to candidates where you have three different level playing fields. It's a huge problem. It's the worst campaign finance law in our country for how employers and unions are treated.
So, final question. I mean, I really appreciate you coming in and engaging with me on this, but I want to get back to sort of the big picture concern that I think a lot of listeners to this show might have, and that is, I feel that American democracy is not just the people that we elect to public office. It's not just the ballot questions that we advocate for or against, but it is those very ideas that we're talking about. That is the fundamental foundation, that engagement, those debates, the disagreement. It's a fundamental foundation of our democracy. It's one of the reasons why I'm still very positive and optimistic about being an American. But what we have seen post-Citizens United is that billions of dollars are being poured into that fight over basic ideas from not that many people, not that many corporations or organizations, and not knowing who they are, what their interests are, and who they represent does put our democracy at risk. Why shouldn't we know people who the people and organizations are that have vast resources to help shape the ideas that define our democracy?
The concern you're raising also is a concern for the other side, right? You're talking about, I want a right of knowing who's members of these organizations. Well, those members of organizations have a right. There are rights for those organizations and those members to be members of those organizations, because they're not doing things. They're in the private sector. They're not government. They're not elected officials. We always have to pause and say, who are we asking to disclose and what do they do? You know, again, if it's a candidate, if it's a party, if it's a super PAC, because their job is to elect or defeat candidates for office. But if it's to a nonprofit who even occasionally engages in the public policy arena, they could accidentally start violating campaign finance law and they don't even know it. And that's another concern that you have to be very careful. When we start treating non-PAC and non-candidate entities as if they're PACs and candidates, don't be surprised if they start violating campaign finance law, because that's not what they're built to do.
All of a sudden what pops into my mind is ignorance of the law is no defense, right? I mean, some of these lawyers are very highly paid. They ought to know better.
Right, but if groups are not built to elect or defeat candidates for office, right, and they occasionally engage in the public policy arena, you know, that's when you start having problems. Because you're building a campaign finance law around candidates and parties, and you're applying to groups that are not candidates or parties.
Well, Paul Craney, board member for the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, thank you so very much for coming in. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.